Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Second Research Symposium on Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Tape 4, Continuation, Session 2, Special Clinical Problems.
That's right, exactly. I think we should, and our speaker is here. Where is he? There he is. No, that's not my job. Union, that's right, exactly. It would be nice if someone else, would anybody willing to volunteer to run back in? Thanks. But we're not going to wait for him. We're going to go right on. Our second half of this program begins with some discussion of the respiratory complications. Dr. Bach.
Thank you. Now, all I have to do is press this forward and I'll hit the first slide. Huh? Let me just see. No, it's not on. Oh, there we go. Okay, let's just go back. Okay, most commonly, the management of severe respiratory insufficiency in patients with post-polio, management is by a tracheostomy placement and tracheostomy intermittent positive pressure ventilation. There are many possible complications of both tracheostomy placement and chronic tracheostomy intermittent pressure ventilation. I'm not going to take the time to go through many of these complications, but it's very safe to say that the great, great majority of these patients are chronically colonized with gram-negative bacteria, that there's a tendency to mucus plug formation, and with it, atelectasis and pneumonia, and that I myself have seen two patients succumb to placement of a tracheostomy tube under semi-emergency conditions. So an attempt to bypass this form of ventilation is the creation of devices of respiratory assistance, such as the rocking bed, which you're probably all familiar with, and forms of negative pressure aid, such as the iron lung, the chest piece, and more recently, the pneumo suit. Now, all of these forms are not practical for a patient dependent on respiratory aid 24 hours a day, because the patient must remain recumbent. Also, with the possible exception of the iron lung, these forms do not work adequately in the presence of severe scoliosis. And as patients age, we found that the decreased compliance and chest wall that these patients have also decreases the volumes that they get on these forms of ventilation. And we've, at Goldwater Hospital, Dr. Albert and our group has sought other means of ventilating these patients. This is a shot of the pneumo belt, which came about in the mid-1950s. It also does not work adequately in the presence of significant scoliosis, nor does it work with the patient supine. So for many years, many of our patients have been ventilated with a chest piece overnight and pneumo belt during the day. And it does work adequately for a long period of time. But as we're finding out now, a number of the patients are ventilated less and less adequately as their vital capacities drop and as their lungs and chest walls become less compliant. This is a cosmetic form of aid, and it's still very popular with the patients. This patient is wearing a pneumo belt, it's under his clothing, and they like it because it's so cosmetic. Perhaps the first means of mouth intermittent positive pressure preceded the perfection of the iron lung. In the literature, in 1928, a fellow used a chimney, a bellows, to ventilate a patient by his mouth. Now, I don't know what happened to the patient. It's not really stated, but this technique predates the iron lung. I just thought I'd mention that. In the early 1960s, with the advent of new and more portable positive pressure ventilators, patients were able to mount these ventilators on their wheelchairs, and the mouthpiece would be adjusted adjacent to the patient's mouth, or sometimes in the mouth. Now, they would use this technique as needed during the daytime. And in the late 1950s, and there's the portable ventilator mounted on the back of a motorized wheelchair, Dr. Albert described the fact that mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation is as effective as tracheostomy ventilation in the well patient. And it can deliver higher volumes than you can deliver with an iron lung. She discovered that as patients would drowse off during the day, their mouthpieces would not leave their mouths, and they were getting adequate ventilation despite the fact that they were fast asleep. Well, this encouraged the people at Goldwater to employ this technique as an assist during sleep. And more recently, the use of the Bennett lip seal has become more widespread with these patients. Now, this patient is set up with his Bennett lip seal, and he developed polio in August of 1955 at the age of 15. He was in an iron lung for 1 year, and then from 1956 to 1981, he used a combination of chest piece overnight and pneumo belt during the day. In 1981, the volumes were decreasing on his chest piece, and he was awaking with some drowsiness, some difficulty sleeping. He was getting less than 350 cc's on the chest piece, and we recommended to him that he switch to mouth positive pressure at that time. He did, and he's been maintaining normal blood gases ever since, and he's symptomatically completely alleviated from his previous symptoms. He continues to use the pneumo belt during the day, however. Yes. Mm-hmm. Some of you may recognize Ira. Now, the mouthpiece can be adjacent to the patient's mouth, as I mentioned. Now, this patient has a sip and puff mechanism to operate her wheelchair, and she has the mouthpiece just adjacent to her mouth. As she needs a breath, an assisted breath, she'll take it. This patient also needs to use glossopharyngeal breathing for the smooth operation of a wheelchair. And I'll discuss that in 2 or 3 minutes. The other way of delivering mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation is to have the mouthpiece actually in the mouth. Now, this gives the patient the freedom of from having to turn her head to that mouthpiece. And for some patients, that's more important. And here, again, the respirator is mounted on the wheelchair and the patient is very active. That patient that I did show, by the way, as there were some questions earlier about quality of life and satisfaction and so on, this patient is part of a $3 million grant, and he's the vice president of the organization that got this grant, called Concepts of Independent Living, and it's involved with providing attendant care for other handicapped people. If there are other questions about satisfaction of life, you know, I'll try to discuss them later on, although they're difficult. Now, looking at some of the data on these patients, although we've been following 81 patients dependent on ventilator care and dependent on mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation, 75 of them and all 66 who are dependent 24 hours a day are followed on the service at Goldwater Memorial Hospital. Of these patients, 43 of them use only mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation 24 hours a day and no other form of respiratory assistance. As you can see, their average vital capacities are 600 cc's. 23 of these patients have been dependent on respiratory aid since their onset of polio, and 20 other, the other 20 patients have become dependent on respiratory aid an average of 18 years following onset of polio. So they have progressively deteriorated, or their deterioration began at some point, to eventually require respiratory assistance. Now, at first, they got assistance usually overnight, but they continue to progress and now are dependent on MIPPV 24 hours a day. We did a study on 20 of these patients and found that they lost vital capacity at 1.8% per year, which is 0.8% greater than normals. Now, they were dependent on negative pressure assistance, as I mentioned, or the rocking bed, for an average of 14 years before switching to mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation, which they've been getting for an average of 13 years and 2 months. Only 4 of these patients have gone to require tracheostomy placement, and 2 of those patients now regret it. And I'll discuss the indications for tracheostomy placement later on. 11 of these patients are deceased, and almost half of the deaths have been attributed to some sort of a chronic respiratory complication, but it's significantly less than half of the patients. The other patients have died from cardiac disease, motor vehicle accidents, cerebrovascular accidents, drug overdoses, and so on. Now, these 23 patients use mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation combined with some other form of non-invasive respiratory aid. Again, 23 of them have been dependent on aid since the onset of polio, but 2 have become dependent on aid 3 and 25 years, respectively, since their onset of polio. They also used negative pressure assistance for an average of 14 years before switching to mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation, which they've been using now for over 16 years on the average. 9 of the patients combine it with chest shell use overnight. 7 of the patients combine it with pneumo belt use during the day. And then there are 6 other patients that combine it with rocking bed overnight, iron lung overnight, and so on. Only two of these patients have been tracheostomized, and as you can see, these are recent tracheostomizations. They're only for the last 2 years that they've received tracheostomy intermittent positive pressure ventilation. And in particular, several of the patients regret it because they've lost their ability to glossopharyngeal breathe. This gave them not only freedom from ventilatory assistance, but a backup from ventilatory care. And again, I'll discuss that. We are following 15 patients. This slide is only the 9 patients from Goldwater who have become dependent on ventilatory aid overnight. Now, if you look at the vital capacities, in the previous group, the average vital capacity was only 485 cc's, or about 12% of predicted normal. They need 24-hour day assistance. Now, in this group, you have about 1 liter on the average. They have symptoms of nocturnal hypoventilation, and they're using mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation overnight, and their symptoms have cleared. They also use it at times during the day, but they're not dependent on it, so I've separated them out from the other because they're not as severe, at least not yet. Let's hope that they don't become. Okay. This is the summary of the series at Goldwater. 75 patients, 31 of them have become dependent on respiratory assistance an average of 30 years and 3 months after their onset of polio. And if you compare the patients that are ventilator dependent around the clock with those who use only overnight aid, you see that their vital capacities are essentially twice as much. There have been 17 deaths. I mentioned something about that before. And I made a little calculation of one death for about every 60 patient years of mouth intermittent positive pressure ventilation. So it's a very safe technique. The complications when you first initiate this method are aerophagia, there's some jaw tension, there's teeth and jaw deformity, which is a cosmetic problem, but none of these complications have necessitated taking the patient off of the method. Okay, thank you. This is an example, of this deformity. You see where the mouthpiece is, and there you have the deformity. Now, if you look at the... here you have that patient that I showed you before, who has a zero vital capacity. He glossopharyngeal breathes. We've asked him to take a maximum glossopharyngeal breaths here, and he averages almost 100 cc's per gulp, a 1.7 a liter average breath, and 5 breaths in 1 minute for about 8.5 liter minute ventilation. When you ask him to take normal glossopharyngeal breaths, he'll breathe 12 times a minute at over 400 cc's of breath. This is almost identical to the volume that he gets on his pneumo belt during the day. In fact, three weeks ago, I observed this patient for over 2.5 hours on glossopharyngeal breathing alone, because again, he has no vital capacity, absolutely zero. And we've had other patients with zero cc vital capacities who were able to glossopharyngeal breathe all day long. So to take away this technique by planting a tracheostomy tube takes away the ability of that patient to get by without a ventilator, the backup that he can get by without the ventilator. Also takes away the ability for the patient to assist his own cough and the ability to speak with a normal pattern, not being dependent on a cycling ventilator. Now here we've asked the patient who has a vital capacity of about 900 cc's to take a maximally a glossopharyngeal breathing assisted breath. And you can see here what the patient can get up to, almost 3 liters. In fact, we have patients with zero vital capacities who can glossopharyngeal breathe up to over 3 liters. This patient was able to use a technique for over 8 hours a day, and he has a zero vital capacity. Here at one point in his life, he was able to glossopharyngeal breathe to 3.3 liters. He left his respirator at home for days, just glossopharyngeal breathing all day long, despite the fact he had a zero vital capacity. He learned the technique in 1961. He became so good at it in 1967 that he was able to do this. And his capacities remained that well until 1982, when they decreased 1 year before he died. He died from cellulitis, lower extremity cellulitis. Now, this is just a table of the 47 or so patients, 46 patients, who were 49 patients. Oh, that should be 13 in group 2, I believe. But these are patients who were trained in glossopharyngeal breathing. About a third of them, or less than a third, do not continue to practice glossopharyngeal breathing. About 23 of them use the technique all day long. And you can see their vital capacities are 330 cc's on the average, but they're what I call the glossopharyngeal maximum single breath capacity, or the deepest glossopharyngeal assisted breath that you can have, averages 1.8 liters, or about 6 times the vital capacity. Okay. Well, it's important to mention that tracheostomy indications are for us other complicating medical conditions. And you can see some of the other indications that we consider for tracheostomy placement. Recurrent atelectasis pneumonia aspiration, patients that are unable to mobilize their own secretions even with glossopharyngeal breathing and so on, who have ineffective buccopharyngeal muscles, anxiety, substance abuse, in small children and so on. I think I'll stop here and leave the rest for questions.
Dr. Weekers, I have a question for you. In your experience, are you finding that the older polio patients who are for the first time having to use some type of assistive device at night are preferring this intermittent positive pressure with this lip seal device over other devices?
Yes, in general, yes, because it does simplify the type of equipment that they have to use. It gives them the ability to take as deep a breath as they want because you've got a manually triggered and or automatically triggered size on the new portable ventilators. You don't have to use negative pressure equipment with positive pressure or a larger non-portable ventilator that does both. And you can use the same ventilator to operate a pneumo belt. So you avoid the excess equipment that you have for negative pressure assistance at night and so on. So the answer is yes, in general.
What brand have you been using?
Of what? Of a respirator?
Yes.
Well, the Life products or the Thompson ventilators, the M2500, the LP456, et cetera, as they come out with the new ones, they all work adequately.
And do you have specific criteria, pulmonary function-wise, which you're using in before you place the patient on assistive?
Yeah, basically, we like to observe their blood gases overnight. I admit the patients and put them on a CO2 metabolic analyzer. If they have normal blood gases during the day, I like to see increased CO2 overnight, significant increase, or a decreased saturation.
And what are you using as significant?
Well, for CO2 is about 50, and for saturation, that's more variable. We get the impression that they desaturate sooner than their CO2s go up. Only recently we've had access to oximeters. But usually the patients complain of symptoms by this time, and we suspect them and then try to observe.
Fugelmeier, North Pole. I have just three short questions. You didn't at all, when talking about cosmetics and quality of life or whatever, discuss phrenic pacing. Why is that?
Well, because phrenic pacing...
May I just come with all my things, and I don't have to. Then the question of pneumo belts. Did I understand that you said that these people who do breathe below their FRC, that they get contractures? That they get rib cage contractures. I thought I heard something. Okay,
no,
it's
no.
Just a Scandinavian here. And finally, can you really teach all patients which might be in need of GPB, can you really teach them that, or have you, what might your percentage of failure be in teaching people that?
Well, I think the previous slide gives some indication to that because about less than one-third of the patients, although they were trained in it, they just didn't seem to master it, or if they did master it, they just never used it. It takes several weeks of practice before you could really measure their gulps and cc's per gulp and so on and feel that they've confidently got the thing going so they can benefit with it. There's also some indication from some preliminary information or results that we have that patients with complicating obstructive lung disease do not gain independence of glossopharyngeal breathing. That if they can glossopharyngeal breathe with zero vital capacities for more than 10 minutes, they probably do not have significant intrinsic lung disease. So the technique is not going to provide complete freedom from ventilators in every patient, but for patients who use it all day, it allows them to speak normally and to even shout where they would not be able to otherwise. Otherwise, they would be dependent on the respiratory cycle of a ventilator. And that's the most common reason for which they actually use the technique, besides the assisted coughing and so on. You mentioned phrenic pacing. Well, I suppose, in theory, I wouldn't expect that this would be effective, since the anterior horn cells would likely be affected for the... I don't know very much about it for this instance. We have used it in New Jersey for patients with spinal cord injury with lesions above C2. But when I even think about phrenic pacing, I realize that it requires generally multiple surgical procedures. It's a $12,000 to $15,000 apparatus. I've seen numerous patients with it, and I haven't seen one yet go a very long time with it. We've had electrode infections, we've had numerous problems. And that's not to say that I discourage it, but every patient on a phrenic pacemaker has to have a portable ventilator as a backup. There are no alarms on phrenic pacemakers. There's no, you can sigh a patient on a phrenic pacemaker, but the lack of alarms disquiets me somewhat. I think they're going to improve the equipment, and perhaps they may have by this time. But I haven't seen patients with post-polio syndrome or ALS, for that matter, to be effectively ventilated with the use of a phrenic pacemaker. Again, we do use it for spinal cord patients that don't have their cells involved. Mm-hmm.
Johnson,
yes.
In Columbus. I thoroughly agree with your approach, except I disagree with your answer to Dave when he said you have to use a lip seal type for nighttime as an initial person who just loses 5% of his vital capacity because he lies down. You could use a much lesser aid.
I don't think I said that.
Well, maybe you didn't understand his question, but that's all right. That's not the point. The point is I thoroughly agree with you, but there is one thing that you said in error, and that is that a person with a tracheostomy plug cannot cross a pharyngeal breathe, because of course they can, and many do,
so
we wouldn't want to leave that.
Right. With the plug tracheostomy tube, yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
There is some leak, though, and it's usually not quite as effective. You normally can't get the volumes that you could otherwise. It's possible to do, but it's just not as effective. You get a leak around the tube.
Mm-hmm. One question.
Yeah.
My name is Fisher from Rancho Los Amigos. I realize that tracheostomies often are just anathema to polio patients, but I have also seen patients prefer to die than to have a tracheostomy, which I think is sort of foolish. And this sort of a reinforcement of the terrible situations that trachs provide, I think, can be costly, because this is what happens. The polios, as they get older, begin to lose their functional ability, and they often can't GPB as well either, and the lungs are getting stiff. So the trach can be a new lease on life in some people, and I think it's not, you obviously want to go without it until you have to, but I you don't want to put it off too long because they
Well, we've been able to put it off for 30 years.
Yeah.
Okay? And these are patients dependent on respiratory aid 24 hours a day, including patients with zero CCA vital capacities. Now, you can't get too much more severe than that.
24 hours a day?
24 hours a day, that's right.
You 66 mean
patients.
PPB during their sleep?
They do MIPPV during their sleep. In fact, that one patient that I did show, he was on a chest piece, the one I mentioned from 1956 to 1981. He awoke on several occasions from failure of his chest piece, and he awoke glossopharyngeal breathing without even realizing what he was doing. So the use of glossopharyngeal breathing can be that effective for these patients. But I think that when you've got intrinsic lung disease and complicating medical factors, that you're right, we have to consider a tracheostomy tube earlier.
Thank you very much, John. We appreciate it. Dr. Fisher is next, so we'll get to hear his further comments on how to manage respiratory failure. But I guess you're talking on sleep disorders, really. But
and we're winding down. Just getting started? Good, yeah. Matt is young. Yes, the topic that I'm going to address has to do with sleep apnea. I did present a couple of cases of sleep apnea in polio patients 2 years ago. But in the past, or since that time, I've become aware of a very high number of polio patients that do have this. It's obvious when you become interested in a particular subject, you get a lot of referrals with people that have this problem. But maybe we could show that first slide to... Did we get our slide up there? I guess I just have to press the button. Turn it on. Yeah, it goes on with that. Anyway, in order to evaluate what we're doing with sleep problems, we often think that if they're sleepy during the day, they're
there must be having some nighttime problems, but that's indicates a difficulty in analyzing some of our... This is a group of polio patients who received a questionnaire. Everybody's sending questionnaires. The group consisted of, say, about 28 patients that had their polio before 1940. And then, of course, going up through the to 1960. And then subsequently, we've had not any polios on our service, but have had a few on the pediatric service. The one of the respiratory problems that occurs with polio, and has been quite common, is the kyphoscoliosis problem. This is produces sleep problems as well as congestive heart failure, the Quasimodo syndrome. Now, on the questionnaire that went around, we sent them to members of the Downey Polio Survivors Association, and I think we had, are still getting perhaps, we're probably around 40% of that group of individuals now. The women were more commonly respondents, and they may be more of them because of the survival of the fittest. The average age was quite similar, and the percentage of daytime sleepiness was rather significant. I tried to do a control here, which I was told by a statistician was appropriate at 0.004. Anyway, the polios had these are people that described, that were sent questionnaires asking about sleep, whether they were sleepy, and whether they woke frequently and snored. And as you see, the percentages of the polios were about 40 to 60%, which the average comes out, I think, at about a 43 when I get some of the other studies, whereas the controls, which I selected from a group of employees at Rancho Los Amigos Hospital who weren't on night shift, who were sleepy during the day. And so this was an interesting development. I didn't expect to see that high a percentage. This is a breakdown of the thing again in relationship to their sleeping poorly of the 75 or 45% that were sleepy during the day. They had the problems not only of being sleepy during the day in a high percentage, sleeping poorly, well, this is sleeping poorly in a high percentage, up about 85 to 95%, and the waking frequently and snoring were quite common, probably in most of them. This this just points out some of the problems in ventilatory control, and I don't want to go through all that in detail, but the body reacts rather strongly to sleep. It does a lot of things that we don't expect it to, and there are a lot of impairments of the normal muscle contractions that go on. Our nose and throat and larynx, as well as our diaphragm, are supposed to function phasically by contracting. And during sleep, and particularly during REM sleep, when there's a loss of general muscle function, there are a lot of difficulties with controlling the airways. And so people often do have sleep snoring and problems and waking up. This again just reports out from the activating system down through the diaphragm and airways like we were talking about. So many of these folks have difficulty controlling the tongue, pharynx, larynx, and keeping them in order, and snoring. And this includes people that have central apnea, which you might expect would be the main thing associated with superficially you'd think, see, that's polios, they had bulbar. Some of them did have bulbar, but many of them didn't. But they are mainly mixed. The plain central is not all that common in the group. One of the simplest things to do, if you can get a hold of the equipment, is to use a respiratrace, which will measure your chest movements and your abdominal movements. And I'm sure we've got people that have had more experience with using polysomnography than I have, but we have used this quite effectively. A bed partner is also an extremely valuable instrument to use in discussing the problems of sleep. Because many patients come into the office and they're sleepy during the day, they wake up quite frequently. But the spouse can very often advise the doctor quite explicitly what's going on with the types of snoring, the stopping of breathing, and having to nudge them and poke them in the ribs periodically during the night is not an uncommon story I get. This is a normal study with the, if you use a nasal airflow and then your respiratrace, you would get a abdominal movement with a slightly lesser chest wall movement, and nasal airflow could be measured. You also at the same time put on an ear oximeter and maybe a thermistor at the mouth and a few things like this and measure CO2s. Now when you have an obstructive phenomenon, you have your abdomen moving pretty heavily sometimes, and this happens to be a central here. So as you can see there, the respiratory movements stop, whereas if we get to the obstructive component, you see the chest wall is not moving quite as well as the diaphragm is, but it's moving to some extent, but there's absolutely no movement through the nasal airflow. These are going to become more and more common, a little easier to work. The units now are becoming pretty compact and less expensive, and don't really probably need a full program for measuring the every sleep variable, although they're nice if you want to publish papers. Symptoms, of course, sonorous snoring, hypersomnolence, abnormal activity during sleep, morning headaches, disorientation on awaking. If they get enough CO2 retention, which some of them do, one of the patients I saw in the office was a clear example of that. She had she was unable to work. She had a tracheostomy, which she'd had for some respiratory failure earlier, so it was pretty obvious what she had. She had obstructive sleep apnea. And it is a rather dramatic thing when you can evaluate that. We always talk about Joe the Fat Boy in the Pickwick Papers, so I thought we'd change the image a little bit, because I think Falstaff is probably a better obstructive sleep apneic than most. Fast asleep behind the iris, which I have to look up. It was a wall hanging, you know. Snoring like a horse. Hark, how hard he fetches breath. The management, which I don't have a slide on, but I think we all kind of know. One of the things that I have used quite effectively, as usually the first thing, is protriptyline, which is vivactyl. It's a tricyclic. But it's quite effective. Apparently works on tightening the pharyngeal muscles. And I would say that it works in maybe a third of patients, maybe more than that if they're obstructive. And it's been quite helpful. Some people get a little wakeful with it. But if that works, it's beautiful. You don't have to worry about the other things. The other aspects, of course, that you can use are In people that have some central components, you can use negative pressure. You might try rocking beds. I've never tried a rocking bed for obstructive apnea, whether that would help. Ultimately, when you get a severe obstructive apnea that doesn't respond to protriptyline or other measures that you may want to institute, need a tracheostomy. I had a man that I tried everything on who weighed 500 and some pounds. He was at classical Falstaff, and nothing seemed to work well except that the protriptyline kept him awake. But he has a trach now, and he all of a sudden has become more alert. He's still annoyed about the discomfort in the procedure, but he realizes that he's a lot better off than he was. So I'll stop there since I only have 2 seconds left. I do think this is a probably a new finding in the extent of which it exists. This is why I didn't think this particularly last 2 years ago, but when I get 43% of a population that don't have necessarily any other predisposition, I think that we're all going to have to be looking for something, be aware, taking histories, and finding out just how common this is. I would like to bring in a group of not people, a random sample, in other words, of our polio group, and maybe do some studies and see how common this really is. I don't know if others have experience with this or any impression.
Buchholz, I have a number of comments, not so much a question, although I certainly appreciate your response to my comments. The first comment is that it's well known that people are notoriously poor judges of their degree of sleepiness or the wellness of their nocturnal sleep, and that's why it's so important to objectively evaluate these issues. Sleepiness can be evaluated by doing sleep latency testing during the day, and I certainly think that it's not simply an academic issue to do complete polysomnography for a full night in the evaluation of suspected sleep apnea. There are many things that can be learned from that. Sleep apnea is often variable between REM and non-REM sleep, so one must look at the full cycling of sleep. Cardiac arrhythmias have to be looked for with EKG monitoring. The degree of oxygen desaturation is important in deciding how aggressively to treat the condition, and so on. So what I'm saying is I think that someone with suspected sleep apnea really deserves complete sleep study, including nighttime and daytime studies. It's an expensive issue, costing about $1,000 or $1,200 in most labs, but it's probably money well spent. That's one point. The second is, I would say that most people treating sleep apnea have not had the kind of success that you mentioned with Vivactyl. Vivactyl probably works in most cases by suppressing REM sleep, during which most sleep apnea occurs or is worse. It's poorly tolerated in many men because of its anticholinergic properties, causing impotence and so on. You didn't mention, and perhaps you have tried these other measures in some patients, the use of things like continuous positive airway pressure, which is rapidly gaining popularity among people treating sleep apnea as a relatively benign and very effective method for overcoming obstructive sleep apnea. Applied by a facial mask, or in terms of surgical options, the use of uvulopalatopharyngoplasty, UPPP, which is certainly much more cosmetically acceptable procedure than a tracheostomy. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you have some comments?
Yes, recently, speaking from last first, the uvulopalatopharyngoplasty has been found to be quite effective in reducing snoring. But the latest word from the sleep labs in our part of the country is that it's not effective in sleep apnea. So that is been brought out only, I think, in the last couple of months.
The data that I'm aware of from places across the country is that UPPP has generally been effective in at least half, and in some centers as many as three-quarters of patients with obstructive sleep apnea. There clearly is a problem in selecting which patients it would benefit, but I would certainly advocate it as a surgical option in advance of a tracheostomy.
Yes, well, I did too until I talked to some people at Irvine, and I think also even up at Stanford they're now beginning to, because I was there within the last year at Stanford and they were proposing it, but now apparently there's been something that hasn't gotten through the literature from what I understand. So that's one thing. Now, we do use CPAP when it's tolerated, a continuous positive airway pressure. And when it works well, it works well. There are a lot of patients that don't tolerate it, though. And so if something besides that can work, good. I think it's worth a try before you do a tracheostomy.
Nick, can we go on to the next question?
Jane Monroe, London. We have studied something like 200 patients with polysomnography who've had a post-viral syndrome, some of whom have had post-polio, and a very high incidence of sleep apnea occurs both obstructive and central. With the obstructive type, we found that postural positioning of the patient can often help. And we have used a number of very simple remedies for the patients. One of them is Slofilin, which is a theophylline derivative in a very small dose as a stimulant, which has been very effective in many of the patients. And delivery of oxygen at 1.5 liters per hour through a number of pieces of equipment that are available. But this is a very simple remedy, and it works extremely well. Thank you.
It does. It does in appropriate patients. I think oxygen certainly is one of the earlier ones that are used and effective. Usually, if the patient's hypoxic, that works quite well. And also, nicotine, like Nicoban, and caffeine are, on occasions, quite helpful in relieving some of those obstructive phenomena.
Okay. I just want to comment on Dr. Buchholz's comments. This is Dr. Alba from New York. On the use of CPAP, you have to have active abdominal muscles because you do change the muscles that you're using in quiet breathing to include some forced expiration to overcome the positive pressure on your airway. If you're a polio patient, that has to be assessed because you have to have the abdominal muscles to be able to do that. In the UPPP, you have to worry about the fact that you may lose your frog breathing capability because you may leak out your nose.
This is the end of side one. Please turn the tape over now and continue listening on side two.